Blog Talk Radio.
I'm a truth terrorist. I'm a knowledge gangster. I'm a black history hitman. I'm a lie killer, urban gorilla. I gotta be a roughneck.
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers. If up the black police, that 13th Amendment. Trying to make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free.
Okay,
free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers. And fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movement for black leadership roles. But we still here, finna build here. Up coins held pro.
Show.
They got me started, lion hearted. I'm the new Mufasa. And I'm all about Umoja, first in Guzu Saba. Let's bring back the black families, we need our father. Single mama, son and daughter, that's root of the problem. Wise up, we wise up, unity is so powerful. Black banks, black schools, black owned, black power moves. You telling lies, if you think this shit's gonna be televised. Black power, be scared guys, they be standing there like they paralyzed, huh? We say fuck the system, cause we above the system. We keep ARs and pistols, shotguns that's worth a crystal. But that's for self-defense, make sure we have no issues. Be sure to leave it at the door if you have it with you. This for them freedom fighters, that lost their freedom. Until they freedom, we screaming carpe diem. This for the general, King Khalid Muhammad. We gon' make your day a holiday, I fuck me promise. Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers. And fuck the black police, that 13th Amendment. Tryna make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free.
Okay,
free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers. And fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movement for black leadership roles. But we still here, finna build here. Up coins hell pro.
RBG. My sisters, my brothers, the council, the elders, cause that's really all I need. We suited, we booted, don't do it, you stupid, we head to the armory. Black woman and goddess, regardless, my heart just don't fuck with misogyny. Bullshit that don't tolerate it, melanated, so you gotta hate it. Barack fucked up another conversation, Trump finna get inaugurated, damn. Unify or die, NBPP.org.
First and foremost, the new Black Panther Party, no other Black Panther Party, we are not violent. We are for self-defense and self-determination. The most violent group in this country are the police. What is taking place by the police departments to black people across this country is ethnic cleansing and genocide. It has escalated since the day that Barack Obama was inaugurated in 2008. We have a people who are only 13% of the population, yet we make up 80% of the prisons. We have 50% unemployment rate in the black community, and it's actually even more than that because they're not counting our people that are in the prison. The 13th Amendment says you cannot be made a slave or indentured servant unless you commit a crime. The 14th Amendment forced our people to be subjects of this government. We never had any say in that. We need our own nation.
Discriminatory policies and practices pervade all stages of the criminal process. Black people are more likely to be stopped by police, detained pre-trial, charged with more serious crimes, convicted, and sentenced more harshly than white people. These national trends are also reflected in California's criminal legal system, both historically and today. In the 2010s, California adopted a series of justice reforms that have substantially reduced mass incarceration. But while incarceration declined nearly across the board, by the end of the 2010s, men and women of color continued to be incarcerated at higher rates than white men and women, and some racial disparities actually widened. The likelihood that men of color were incarcerated at the state level compared to white men generally increased during the 2010s. In 2019, black men made up 28% of men incarcerated by the state, nearly five times higher than their share of all men in California, and Black women made up 26% of women incarcerated by the state, more than four times higher than their share of all women in California. Additionally, when Black Californians are subjected to traffic stops, they are at least twice as likely to be asked to step out of a vehicle, to be handcuffed, or to experience a stop involving an officer's weapon. They are twice as likely to be booked into jail, despite the fact that searches of Black people are less likely to result in the officer finding contraband. Next slide. Because of the well-documented overrepresentation of Black people in the criminal legal system, the economic cost that that system imposes fall disproportionately on Black people. These costs begin shortly after arrest with the requirement to pay money bail. Whether the person pays bail, almost always by paying a non-refundable fee to a bail agent, or whether the person remains in jail awaiting trial, they and their family experience enormous costs. Next slide. Money bail amounts in California are extraordinarily high. The median bail amount in California of $50,000 is more than five times the median bail amount in the rest of the country. Because money bail in California has historically been so expensive, the vast majority of people cannot afford to pay the full amount of refundable bail to the court. They therefore are forced to avail themselves of the non-refundable fees and predatory practices of the bail bond industry. Next slide. Commercial bail bond companies in California require people to pay non-refundable premiums of 10% of the full bond bail amount. Companies keep these premiums regardless of case outcome, even when formal charges are never filed in court, charges are dismissed, or the arrestee appears in court for all required hearings. Those who purchase or co-sign a bail bond, usually the family or friends of the arrestee, typically sign a legal contract obligating them to pay the full bail amount if a court date is missed. Occasionally, the bail agent requires the arrestee or family or friends to collateralize the full bail amount with real or personal property. If bail is forfeited, the agent may require payment of the full bail amount, in addition to other costs associated with the failure to appear and bond forfeiture proceedings. If neither the arrestee nor the cosigner is able to satisfy these costs with cash, the bail agent may seize and liquidate any collateral, often the home or personal property of the arrestee's family or friends. Next slide. Although paying non-refundable fees to bail agents can be ruinously expensive, the economic consequences of not paying money bail and remaining in pretrial detention are often as bad or even worse. When people are jailed, even just for a few days, they're at risk of losing their job, their income, and their housing. This sets off a cycle of jailing and poverty that can be nearly impossible to get out of. Not only do people held in pretrial detention often lose their jobs, but pretrial detention also has long-term effects on an individual's employment. A recent study found that 3 to 4 years after a bail hearing, people arrested who are not released are 9.4% less likely to be formally employed. People held in pretrial detention often lose their housing due to inability to pay rent. Income loss can also push individuals deeper into debt through missed payments to creditors, leading to a cycle of economic harms as vehicles and items needed for work are repossessed. Pretrial detention also puts enormous pressure on individuals to plead guilty. By cutting people off from family, friends, jobs, and communities, and subjecting them to the miserable conditions in jails, the criminal system puts arrestees in a position where they face huge incentives to plead guilty in order to end or minimize their pretrial detention. Numerous studies show that people who are detained pretrial are more likely to be convicted, more likely to receive a sentence of incarceration, receive longer sentences, and pay higher court fees. These negative case outcomes prolong separation from families and inability to make any significant amounts of money. Next slide. Next slide. The disproportionate number of Black people arrested and charged, the higher bail amounts required of Black arrestees, and the wealth gap for Black families combine to put a disproportionate number of Black people in pretrial detention, suffering the negative consequences discussed previously. One study found that Black men receive money bail that is 35% higher on average when controlling for the seriousness of the offense. It also found that money bail amounts for Black people are on average $7,000 higher for violent crimes and $13,000 higher for drug crimes. Another study revealed that Black arrestees were 66% more likely than white arrestees to be jailed pretrial. Looking at similarly situated arrestees, Black arrestees were twice as likely as white arrestees to receive bond amounts they could not afford. Compounding the issue of higher bail amounts is the fact that Black families are less likely to be able to pay any amount of bail because of the wealth gap. The average wealth for white families is 7 to 10 times higher than average wealth for Black families. More than 1 in 4 Black households have zero or negative net worth. This gap represents the accumulated effects of centuries of institutionalized and economic racism. Next slide. And next slide. Bail or pretrial detention are only the beginning of the many costs that the criminal legal system disproportionately inflicts on Black people. Another direct cost of the system are fines imposed as punishment following convictions and fees which are charged to raise revenue for the court system. The majority of California's fees date back to the 1990s on the heels of the super predator myth, a racist and debunked theory that predicted an increase in violent crime due to a generation of Black youth who were supposedly prone to violence. As part of an effort to stave off the so-called super predators, the California legislature enacted numerous fines and fees, many that are still in use today. In recent years, California has become a leader nationwide in eliminating certain court fees and forgiving debts. But the laws do not go far enough. They have left in place county-level criminal fines, state and local criminal fees, and non-criminal fines and fees imposed by the state as well as local governments. They also did not reform or eliminate the state's fees for traffic tickets, which are among the highest in the country and disproportionately affect Black people. Black adults in California remain up to 10 times more likely than white adults to be cited for a low-level infraction. One. Next slide. Thank you. The incarceration of a loved one often has a profoundly destabilizing economic impact on immediate family members. Family members absorb financial costs of jailing, such as attorney's fees, phone calls, travel expenses, and commissary bills. These costs begin to stack up at the same time the family is losing the financial support of their loved one. A 1998 study of the female partners of incarcerated Black men in a California state prison found that on average, women were spending $292 a month on visits, phone calls, and packages, equivalent to more than $450 today. Families also bear opportunity costs. People with incarcerated loved ones report that the incarceration has required them to work more hours, get a different job, or turn down an educational opportunity. The costs place strain on key familial relationships and communities. Prisoners speak of their reluctance to call family while in prison because of the monetary burden prison phone calls place on their loved ones. This strain on family relationships is starkly counterproductive to the goal of rehabilitation, as studies have shown that the most important factor in a prisoner's successful reentry is a strong family relationship. Next slide. While California has made efforts to lower its incarceration rate and reduce racial disparities in the criminal legal system, decades of mass incarceration and racist laws and practices mean that significant generational damage has already been done. When a parent is incarcerated, family income drops significantly, and extended family members may have to share custody of children and take on additional caretaking labor. Families often obtain little to no increase in financial or material support when assuming child care roles. This lack of support and loss of resources creates a burden for family members across generations and pushes both older adults and children deeper into poverty. Once they have been released, justice-involved people face thousands of legal sanctions that can prevent them from getting a job, obtaining a license, attaining and maintaining housing, qualifying for public assistance, pursuing higher education, and changing immigration status. People with criminal records also face discrimination in hiring decisions. These impacts lead to higher rates of homelessness and unemployment, lower cumulative earnings, and difficulties pursuing educational opportunities. The consequences of having a criminal record have direct and substantial impacts on families, particularly minor children. The barriers undermine the family's well-being in terms of income, savings, and assets, education, housing, and stability, and in turn negatively affect family cohesion. As a result, people with records lose access to opportunities, driving and keeping their families in poverty across generations. Next slide. As I hope this testimony has made clear, the disproportionate costs that the racially biased criminal legal system imposes on Black families are readily identifiable and quantifiable. These costs have harmed generations of Black Californians and continue to cause immense suffering to this day. It is crucial that an accounting of the debts owed to Black Californians as a result of the state's racist policies and practices include the costs of the criminal legal system. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Catherine Hubbard, for your expert testimony. It was incredibly informative. So we'll now go to our last panelist for this particular panel, which is Max Markham. Max Markham, you can begin your expert testimony when you're ready.
Good afternoon to the members of the task force, and thank you for having me speak today. Thank you, Chair Moore, for your recognition. And I have to say, on a personal note, I'm very honored to join such distinguished panelists, many of whom whose books I have on the bookshelf behind me. My name is Max Markham. I am the Vice President of Policy and Community Engagement at the Center for Policing Equity, which is a research and action organization focused on equity in policing that uses science to identify and reduce the causes of racial disparities in police interactions and advocate for large-scale and meaningful changes in public safety. I join you today on behalf of CPE in order to discuss the history of anti-Black racism in policing and to address the ways that reimagining public safety and investing in Black communities can serve as a positive step forward towards needed reconciliation and healing in this country. The Center for Policing Equity maintains the National Science Foundation-funded National Justice Database, which we understand to be the largest collection of police behavioral data in the world. Our work focuses on combining police behavioral data, psychological survey data, and data from the United States Census to estimate racial disparities in police outcomes, such as stops and use of force, and additionally, the portion of those disparities for which law enforcement is responsible and can do something about. We use the National Justice Database in turn to support the Justice Navigator, which is an interactive tool containing targeted analyses of police data and a range of resources to help drive changes to public safety. At CPE, we recognize that communities should be the architects of their own solutions, plain and simple. With that in mind, my team at CPE ensures that our work centers community voices and perspectives throughout our products, analyses, and policy recommendations. It is our goal to capture the community sentiment regarding public safety and highlight experiences while addressing community needs. To do this, my team conducts detailed interviews with community members as part of a comprehensive qualitative data collection effort that informs policy recommendations to police and local government partners. My team also ensures that communities can easily access and understand our organization's analytic reports, such as Justice Navigator assessments, which ensures accessibility and transparency. Likewise, our public safety redesign work in cities such as Berkeley, Ithaca, and St. Louis seeks to empower communities to express their needs directly and allows and supports them in crafting redesign recommendations and policy changes. I'll begin my testimony with a quick overview of policing, with the understanding this is surely not new information to members of the panel, but hopefully serves to contextualize our policy recommendations with also the understanding that there's limited time today. And then I'll turn to anti-Black bias and historic and current instances of policing and some policy highlights. The first policing organizations in the United States originated in the early 1700s as slave patrols, or vigilante-style groups of white men who enforced the practice of enslavement. They were selected and compensated by local governments, and they used systemic surveillance, terror, and violence to capture and return people who had fled slavery and deter uprising. In the following century, formal municipal police departments began in major cities such as New York and Chicago. These departments lacked training or standards, they were frequently corrupt, and they focused on controlling disorder along with crime. In the early 1900s, police departments were restructured and their goals were redefined to more closely resemble the police department that we see today. By then, technology had made it easier for members of the public to contact the police directly, which effectively allowed officers to distance themselves from the communities that they worked in. By the 20th century, policing had evolved significantly, though the roots of racism in policing were not eradicated. After the Civil War, police departments throughout the South enforced oppressive Reconstruction-era black codes, as we've heard already, which dictated how and where newly freed people could work, travel, and even live. In the 20th century, predominantly white male police officers in the South enforced Jim Crow laws. They ignored lynchings and they used violence in response to civil rights era protests. In the 1980s and 1990s, an increased focus on targeting minor crimes through foot patrol and the war on drugs resulted in an increased number of officers on the street, especially in non-white communities. And likewise, sweeping penalization measures such as the Violent Crime Control and Law Enforcement Act of 1994, better known as the 94 Crime Bill, set the stage for mass incarceration and disparities in sentencing, many of which remain persistent sources of inequity today. And after the September 11th terrorist attacks, there was a further increase in local police budgets, militarization tactics, and surveillance authority in Black, Brown, and Muslim communities. Because of these policing tactics, as well as other changes to the criminal justice system, there was a fourfold increase in the number of people incarcerated and imprisoned between 1980 and 2009. Today, there are more than 1.1 million people employed as police across approximately 18,000 law enforcement agencies nationwide. However, while local police agencies in cities have officers patrolling the street and are tasked with maintaining order and enforcing the law, serious crime is typically not a large driver of community calls for service or of police activity. In one analysis of police departments' work, it was found that 4% of officer time was spent on serious crime. And depending on what resources exist in communities, police are often tasked with a wide range of other duties, from mental health crises to responding to weather emergencies. In California, like many other states, redlining and discriminatory mortgage and lending practices deprived Black Americans of access to neighborhood capital, healthcare, social services, and quality education systems, underscored by the belief that Black people would bring crime and undesirable activity into neighborhoods. As many of your other expert witnesses have testified, and far more eloquently than I, the legacy of these racist housing and economic policies has resulted in stark racial disparities in wealth, in home ownership, in health, in education outcomes that are all visible in many California communities and frequently deepened by infrastructural and environmental disinvestment. These same communities who have felt the historic impact of disinvestment also tend to be the most heavily policed and overly subject to punitive criminal policies, which in turn spurs a cycle of distrust of government and lack of participation in government. Thus, the unique needs of these communities are frequently underrecorded, and the power and strength of the community goes underutilized. The American public, and Black Americans in particular, have very low trust in police. Nearly 50% of Black Americans have little to no confidence that local police treat Black and white Americans equally, and for good reason. Black people are disproportionately more likely to be stopped by the police, more likely to have police use force against them, and are more likely to be killed by police, especially when unarmed, as previous witnesses have indicated as well. And it should surprise no one to hear that an increased risk of police violence can and frequently does result in individual and collective trauma, which exacerbates all of the aforementioned community disadvantages. And likewise in California, anti-Black racism is a root cause of mistrust between law enforcement agencies and the communities that they're sworn to protect and serve. A routine traffic stop of two Black teenage brothers in the neighborhood of Watts in Los Angeles in 1965 erupted into a fight between the community and police and led to 34 deaths and thousands of injuries and arrests. As they were known, the Watts riots drew attention to the fact that a white police force patrolling the neighborhood was not representative of the community that it served, in addition to the brutal tactics of the militarized Los Angeles Police Department. Less than 30 years later, the culture of brutality and racism was brought again to the forefront of the public eye after the acquittal of four officers caught on tape brutally beating Rodney King in the course of an arrest. Technological advances and the highly public nature of police use of force incidents over the past decade have once again called increased attention to the dangerous implications of bias policing for Black American safety. In the 2009 execution of an unarmed Oscar Grant by a Bay Area rapid transit officer in Oakland led to uprisings in the Bay Area and served as a very important precursor to movement in defense of Black lives and well-being. But to understand the factors that create inequitable policing, it's important to first understand how deeply ingrained cultural stereotypes can influence people's perceptions and behavior. Due to these stereotypes, people automatically associate Black people with criminality, with aggressiveness, and with danger. People perceive neighborhoods' crime problem to be worse when more Black people, particularly young Black men, live in it, even after accounting for differences in actual crime rate. And people also view Black children as older and less innocent than white children of the same age. This is a concept known as adultification and anger bias and can lead to Black children's emotional expressions to be misperceived as angry or aggressive, increasing the likelihood that Black children will be subject to harsher treatment by law enforcement and in schools. These stereotypes that I listed have consequences for encounters between police and members of the public. Stereotypes can lead people to interpret the same facial expressions or behaviors as more hostile or threatening when looking at a Black person as compared to a white person, and can affect how people perceive another person's speed and motion. Racial bias can also influence how accurately and quickly people identify the presence of weapons, making people more likely to shoot unarmed Black people than unarmed white people in simulations, especially when they're new to shooting. However, police departments can play an integral role in reimagining public safety and shifting the narrative away from overly punitive or deadly measures that can lead to disinvestment in Black communities. When departments understand the factors that increase risk of disparate policing, they can in turn take steps to address them. For example, setting and enforcing clear, unambiguous expectations of officer behavior is one important way for departments to promote equity. Creating clear norms of expected behavior can make officers more likely to treat people fairly. Officers working under more restricted use of force policies, for example, have been shown to use force less readily than officers working under less restrictive policies. Norms and rules, obviously, however, can only go so far, and effective accountability mechanisms are a crucial pairing. For an example of the effect of accountability, we can turn to New York, where the New York Police Department requirement to document all stops appears to have limited unnecessary stops because it increased officers' perceptions that their decisions were under increased scrutiny and had a higher risk of sanction. Likewise, there are cultural changes that can be made to a department that can reduce the risk of disparate behavior. Can strengthen procedural justice or the fairness within departments, which may help improve officers' well-being and their endorsement of democratic forms of policing. Organizational changes, such as shift length policies and schedule changes, can go a long way to reduce the risk of cognitive depletion of officers. And similarly, internal policies that promote de-escalation tactics can help reduce feelings of time pressure and threats during encounters with community members. There's a growing body of literature that suggests that diverse representation within police forces is associated with lower hate crime rates. Police officers reflecting the communities they patrol create space for value alignment and can have positive implications on public safety. But centering Black communities in these conversations related to public safety and past harm is one of the most crucial ways that can lead to empowerment and solution building and may also facilitate greater trust between law enforcement and those they seek to protect. But looking to the future, there is a clear appreciation for the systems that have not worked and an appetite for public safety redesign writ large. Nationwide demonstrations against police violence have created unprecedented conversations around the allocation of public safety resources in American cities. As communities chart paths towards new models of public safety, many communities and government decision makers are asking questions about how to do so without risking violence, without aggravating racial disparities, or producing other unintended consequences that don't serve communities calling for change. Communities can and should feel empowered to assess what resources, police or otherwise, are required to fill their community's needs while identifying neighborhoods most in need of additional investment. In order to reduce police footprints in communities, inefficiencies in policing should be measured and mapped. Likewise, investments can be targeted to communities that have been overburdened by crime or policing. Policymakers can and should create stronger social safety nets in these neighborhoods by delivering more social services to residents, including cash subsidies, hospitals, mental health treatment centers, and substance abuse facilities. Policymakers can also invest in and provide credit to local businesses such as grocery stores that enhance community well-being. Community input must be broadly sought throughout community surveys to help quantify the exact kinds of services needed and not oversaturate communities with services that they are not asking for and do not need. Policymakers should create spaces for conversations, physical conversations, in-person conversations with community members to obtain their input on public safety services and policy. But in order to prevent violence and create safer communities with smaller law enforcement footprint, we can use and invest in community resources. Community-led violence intervention programs, for example, like Life Camp in New York, and community-led crisis intervention teams like the CAHOOTS program started in Eugene, Oregon. CAHOOTS stands for Crisis Assistance Helping Out on the Streets, CAHOOTS, in Eugene, Oregon, show promise of low-cost, community-centered, and nonviolent alternative responses. Similarly, community navigator model like the one in Minneapolis allows trained city employees instead of police to respond to victims of crime, of homelessness, or other concerns where there is not an immediate threat of violence. Similar community-centered response models exist around the country and the globe. And just as a last example, there are targeted cash subsidies that can mitigate these risk factors. Basic income programs like the SEED program in Stockton, California have shown a lot of promise in improving the wellness, financial stability, employment, and mental health of the participants, and may in turn help to reduce violence and crime in communities. You know, only police departments that understand the factors that cause disparate outcomes can help build equity. This is a necessary acknowledgement, and it provides that a path towards healing is possible through a reimagined public safety system that does not criminalize Black people and create disparate outcomes, but instead centers community and takes a holistic and historically informed approach to public safety. Again, on a personal note, I want to thank the task force members and members of the public for your time today. I appreciate the depth and breadth of expert and personal testimony that this body has thought over such a prolonged period of time to truly address meaningful and structural opportunities for healing in the country. And I look forward to further discussions and collaboration. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Mr. Markham, for your excellent expert testimony. At this time, I would like to turn to the task force in the event that they have any comments or questions for the panelists.
Mila, I just want to thank the panelists. Thought the testimony was excellent. Thank you so much.
The task force. I just have a quick question for Dr. Roseberry and anyone else who would like to respond. Can you speak about any potential redress recommendations as it relates to systemic changes and guarantees of non-repetition?
I'm sorry, I heard you say systemic changes. I didn't hear the last part of your question.
I guess you could say comparing systemic changes to the idea of guarantees of non-repetition.
Yeah, I think your question was systemic change in the area of non-representation as in indigent cases?
Or not non-repetition, so essentially preventing future harms in terms of, like, your remarks, in terms of, like, anti-African-American bias and hate crimes and stuff like that.
Thank you.
And not just the personal, but the institutional, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think that the biggest way to prevent repetition is to rein in the discretion that actors in the system have. I spoke a little bit about the qualified immunity that police officers have. Prosecutors, too, have a great deal of discretion in their charging, and judges have some discretion as well in the sentences that they give. And this discretion is largely unchecked. We need to be able to have these servants of the people be held accountable. And so it, commensurate with this idea of checking discretion is transparency. We need to know what's going on inside our prisons. We need to know how prosecutors are making the decisions they make. We need to know about the disciplinary procedures or lack for police officers. We need to know what's happening with police officers in our schools. So, you know, throughout the entire system, since we are paying for it, we need to know what is happening. I will note that I have a good friend who's British who was incensed to find out that until 2015, her tax dollars were paying for reparations to slave owners in Great Britain. Had there been some transparency around that, I imagine she would have pushed back against that. And so we need more transparency and accountability in our system.
The panelists like to answer that question or follow up with what she said. Any other task force members have any last comments? Thank you so much to our esteemed panelists for providing personal expertise.
I have my hand up.
I'm sorry, I didn't see you. Member Rose, you're recognized.
Thank you. This question is perhaps primarily for Max Markham, but actually for any of the panelists. And first and foremost, thank you for the information that you shared. It's been very helpful. My question really goes to the issue of prevention and what role do you see prevention playing in addressing some of these examples of anti-Black racism, and not only just prevention, but prevention that centers the community in the efforts. For example, like in Los Angeles, you know, the use of GRID, where you have community members who are central to efforts at violence prevention, and then also perhaps the role of community organizers helping to bring the community to the table to have input on prevention strategies, as opposed to some academic coming up with something based on their theoretical understanding of what prevention is about.
Yeah, absolutely, and thank you for that question. I think the answer is not. There is no one-size-fits-all answer, right? And I think you hit the nail on the head when you articulated the need to involve, I hope and think that my testimony touched on this as well, the need to involve community at every step of the way, and not in a way that is, actors building solutions for communities and then giving them to the communities, but ensuring that communities can be architects of their own solutions, right? So there's a number, to the question of prevention, there are a number of short, medium, and long-term steps that should be taken on, you know, norms and rules internally, speaking specifically to policing, norms and rules, mechanisms for accountability. The norms and rules are intended to address prevention. The measures of accountability are in place should prevention not succeed for there to be accountability, but also they increase the likelihood that use of force and bias will be discouraged in the first place because of the existence of that accountability. So that's one piece of it, but I think that speaks more to your point of, you know, policymakers and academics setting standards and policies as opposed to allowing the actual community and supporting the community in dictating what it needs and what it wants. And that's where programs like, violence intervention programs like Life Camp, right? We have them all throughout New York City. They exist in a number of states, some that follow the cure violence model, hospital-based violence interventions, where people are able to, you know, there is violence that has occurred or there is violence that has historically occurred, but instead of turning directly to law enforcement to mitigate potential, you know, revenge killings or additional violence, we turn to community members who have, you know, who are commonly referred to as credible messengers, people who understand their community, understand the population that lives in that community, and can seek to mitigate those kinds of harms through conversations, through programming, through mentorship, through job training. Those are the kinds of programs that are highly deserving of investment and have not been funded by policymakers historically because of the exact same comment that you made, Chairwoman Grill or Member Grills, that they're not necessarily based on evidence, right? In that same way that we are used to being able to call on. So that's something that needs to change and something that communities really should feel empowered to participate in despite cycles and histories of disinvestment.
Thank you. And could I ask one other quick question? The other issue is that, you know, we're talking about anti-Black bias, and oftentimes what that invokes in people's minds is Black and white. But the truth of the matter is that we've got this white adjacent pecking order that all racial groups are trying to get as close to white adjacent as possible and as far away from Black as possible, which means that everybody ends up drinking some of the Kool-Aid of white supremacy. And in that regard, you know, one of the things that we're facing in the LA county jails is, particularly in the women's jail, is the issue of anti-Blackness directed against the Black women incarcerated. And it's not coming from the white officers as much as it is from the Latinx officers or, you know, sheriff staff. And so do you see any role for and any potential effectiveness for training around anti-Blackness? Do you think that's going to move the needle, or should we just stay closer to policies?
I'd like to answer that. So, Darius Young, one of the things that I would say is this, right? First of all, you need to continue to have training, but I would also say this. You can't out-train somebody how to be unbiased or have these racist attitudes, because we have to understand, right? This was laid out, you know, for people, white people, Latinx people, whoever you want to call it, years and years ago when they came out with these theories on Black inferiority. So let's make that, and so when you talk about training, you can't out-train a person's heart. So in that regard, you keep on doing the training, but the other thing is to hold people accountable. And if people are held accountable, they have to be held accountable. And I do think that within this system of oppression, people do not get held accountable, especially in the criminal justice system. It gets passed along because most of the time, when you're dealing with the state prisons and county jails, it's kind of like operating behind the Iron Curtain because people get away with more than what they're held accountable for and what gets reported because people just aren't looking because it's a thought, well, you know, we're not violating anybody really because all they are just like products, shipments, you know, cargo or whatever. And so it takes somebody to have to stumble over something real atrocious in order for us to be investigations, in order for people to truly, truly be held accountable.
Thank you. Thank you so much to the panelists. Thank you again for your time. We'll move on to our next agenda item, which is panel number 3, agenda item 19, history of policing and war on drugs. So our speakers are as follows. Aaron Harvey, Aaron Harvey is unable to participate today. So we have DeAndre. So DeAndre Brooks, sorry. Could someone mute? Before I introduce the speakers, do we have Congresswoman Maxine Waters? Is she here? Okay, she was listed as to be determined, but I don't think she's here today. So we have DeAndre Brooks, because Aaron Harvey was unable to participate today. Brooks spent his young adult years incarcerated, but decided to take control of his future and manifesting a new life for himself. He is now pursuing a Master's of Public Administration from San Diego, where he received his bachelor's degree. He is a member of San Diego Commission on Gang Prevention and Intervention and a Juvenile Justice Program Associate at the Children's Initiative in San Diego. We'll also hear from Genevieve Jones Wright. Jones Wright was a San Diego County, worked as a San Diego County Public Defender from 2006 to 2019. She co-founded and serves as the executive director of an impact litigation nonprofit, Community Advocates for Just and Moral Governance, which works to achieve racial and social justice and holds government accountable to all people, especially those who are marginalized. We'll also hear from Dave Minchell. Dave Minchell is a criminal defense attorney and a president of Vital Projects Fund, a charitable foundation that seeks to end mass incarceration with a focus on curtailing cruel and excessive sentences, holding police and prosecutors accountable, ameliorating barbaric prison conditions, and reaffirming the humanity of incarcerated people. And then last, we'll hear from Charles Ramsey, who is a former Washington, D.C. Chief of Police, Philadelphia Police Commissioner, co-chair of President Obama's Task Force on 21st Century Policing. So without further ado, DeAndre, we're going to begin your testimony.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is DeAndre Brooks, and I am honored to be here today. I wanted to speak to policing and the war on drugs and the effects and impacts it's had on myself and my community alike. And I just want to say that it created a lot of fatherless homes, single-parent homes, which caused individuals like myself and my friends to kind of gravitate toward the street life and to join gangs. A lot of heavy presence of police in our communities and just stripping us of our male role models in general. Personally, after I joined gangs, I got involved in some bad situations. But unfortunately, I went to prison for 10 years for a crime that I did not commit, just being involved in and being around gang members. So I served 10 years in prison for something that I didn't do and a crime I didn't commit. And I've come home to try to get my life on track and still have to interact with law enforcement and be treated as less than. Traffic stops on a regular basis for failure to stop at stop signs, things like that that never occurred. Purchasing brand new cars and just being seen driving brand new cars, and the police just feel like they have the ability to pull you over and question you. And then once I start speaking, they want to let me go and no charges are ever filed. But just the fact that you have to go through that in your communities and that heavy presence is there, it makes the community not like law enforcement. And it kind of just continues to put the community in a position to where they feel as if we're just not supported all the way around. And I definitely appreciate you guys for having this panel and session on these issues. I've been listening to a lot of the data that's come through. I just wanted to kind of like put a real life experience and connect that with all the data and the information that has been here today.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for your testimony. And thank you for being able to present on such short notice. So we'll now turn to,
thank you.
We'll now turn to Ms. Genevieve Jones Wright. Welcome, and you can begin your testimony, expert testimony, when you're ready. Ms. Jones, right?
Thank you. I am hoping that because my dear friend DeAndre Brooks did not take advantage of his allotted time, that I may be seated some of this time. I do not want to talk too fast, but I do have lots to say, and I wasn't made aware that we were going to be reduced down to 10 minutes. So I'm going to try to do the best that I can do and stay within the confines of time. But thank you. My name is Genevieve Jones Wright, and I really want to thank you for this opportunity to present testimony on the history of policing in San Diego. As you all well know, we cannot divorce our current policing systems or any system in this country, for that matter, from their racist roots in white supremacy. Slavery existed in this country before it was a country, and the effects of slavery still persist in today's society. The biased policing we see in our communities is firmly rooted in the systematic mistreatment and dehumanization of Black people. It is easy to directly correlate what we see in our prisons and our jails as far as numbers with what happens in our courts as judges sentence people to prison and jail. What I have seen in my law practice as a criminal defense and civil rights attorney, however, is how policing directly impacts what we see happen in our courtrooms. When a person has more contacts with law enforcement because they live in an over-policed neighborhood or because their skin is seen as a threat to police officers or as probable cause, they will have more involvement with the criminal court system. As we have discussed earlier through earlier testimonies, after the Civil War, slave patrols were used to round up newly freed men and women, their violation, walking around Black and free. And unfortunately, this violation still results in a disproportionate rate in which African Americans engage in the criminal legal system. In the overview of my testimony, I wrote that California's vagrancy and loitering laws were spawns of the Black codes and the Jim Crow laws that were prominent in southern states. This by no means was meant to infer that these racist laws never made their way to California. They most certainly did. Segregation was firmly established in California in 1870. And what's not commonly known is that the California Supreme Court upheld a law mandating school segregation, holding that the 14th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution did not bar segregation, 20 years before the United States Supreme Court adopted this rationale in its infamous Plessy versus Ferguson decision. So although California entered the Union as a free state in 1850, prohibiting slavery in our Constitution, it enacted its own Jim Crow laws between 1850 and 1947. The criminalization of societal issues like homelessness are consistent with the early days of policing, where vagrancy and unemployment were policed formally through Black codes that we also heard about earlier that severely restricted the freedom of Black people living in the South. The defining feature of Black codes was broad vagrancy laws, which allowed local authorities to arrest freed people for minor infractions and commit them to involuntary labor. It is worth noting that homelessness is heavily criminalized in San Diego County, and that Black people make up 22% of people experiencing homelessness, despite only being 6% of the population. And that, as Voice of San Diego reported in 2020, African Americans were disproportionately impacted by the enforcement of rules relating to the COVID-19 pandemic, despite the overall number of arrests and tickets in San Diego falling dramatically after public health officials ordered people to stay home. A Voice of San Diego analysis of San Diego Police Department crime data found that one out of every four violations of various emergency orders went to a Black person. They went further and explained that it wasn't just in the category of public health where Black San Diegans were overrepresented. Indeed, the very history of California starts with anti-Blackness. California's first governor, Peter Burnett, in his first State of the State address remarked that after much reflection, he determined that keeping Black people out of California altogether would be the best policy. California's first governor pushed for a complete ban of Black people from entering the state as one of the first items of business for the newly formed state, and so did some of the men who wrote California's Constitution. It is with this backdrop of history that I offer my testimony on the history of policing in San Diego this afternoon. I will lift up the stories of three valiant Black men I believe are critical to understanding how policing in San Diego is directly tied to the need for white people and particularly law enforcement actors to maintain and exert control over Black bodies. I hope to help this important task force understand how policing practices, norms, cultures, and their detrimental effects, all rooted in white supremacy, continue to affect Black communities today, and why it is important to dismantle our criminal legal and policing institutions as they now exist. When the San Diego Police Department was established in 1889, one of the prerequisites for being a police officer was being a white male. It's no wonder that when the first Black officers joined SDPD, they were forbidden by their superiors to arrest lawbreakers if they were white. Now think about that. And how could a Black officer testify against a white offender when California's Jim Crow laws did not allow non-whites to testify against white people in a court of law? This brings me to the story of the grandfather of one of my oldest friends from childhood. Detective Johnny Williams joined the San Diego Police Department in 1952 as a quote-unquote beat cop. He was one of the earliest African-American police detectives in San Diego, and he served with distinction 26 years until 1978. During his tenure, he was known for his exceptional investigative and interrogation abilities, notably carried out with fairness and determination to do the right thing. His skills were so remarkable that some of his interrogations were used as models statewide in recruit training. As outstanding as he was assigned to work only with other African-American officers and only in cases that involved African-Americans for many years on the force. And as a matter of policy, he was expressly prohibited from arresting white offenders. Being the honorable man he was, he took his oath seriously, and Detective Williams did not comply with that prohibition. These were the stories that he told his children and grandchildren. And these stories of discriminatory practices within SDPD were later confirmed in an interview published in 1996 through the words of Detective William Ritchie, who joined the San Diego Police Department in 1935 before Detective Williams. I share with you about Detective Williams to illustrate how profoundly policing is rooted in white supremacy. If a Black officer was not worthy enough to confront or arrest a white man who was breaking the law, how will a Black man or woman be seen as worthy of respect and human dignity when encountered by a white cop on his beat? What prevents the actors within police institutions from treating every Black person they see as a criminal or as a threat or a gang member who needs to be neutralized? Which brings me to the story of Saigon Penn. On May 31, 1985, Saigon Penn, a 23-year-old Black man, was driving his car in the Encanto neighborhood of Southeast San Diego, where I live, when he and his passengers were racially profiled as gang members by two San Diego police officers, Donovan Jacobs and Tom Riggs, despite none of them being involved in gangs or having a history of doing so. Upon being stopped, Penn, a beloved member of the community and a prolific martial artist, was met with what was intended to be offensive and provocative gang language before he was asked for his ID. What ensued was a beat down by Riggs and Jacobs, who began to kick, punch, and beat Penn with a baton. Despite Penn being on the ground with an officer on top of him holding him down and him yelling, "I give up, you've got me now," the officers continued to beat him. Penn defended himself as he had every right to do, managed to block some of the officer's blows, and gained possession of Jacobs' revolver, killing Jacobs and injuring Riggs and their ride-along passenger. Penn was also wounded during this episode of gratuitous police violence. Notably, a fellow officer testified in support of Penn and testified that Officer Jacobs was a quote-unquote racist hothead. The San Diego Police Department and its chief, never ones to engage in self-reflection in any meaningful way, criticized the DA for not seeking the death penalty and denied any wrongdoing on the part of the officers. After two trials, Penn was acquitted of the murder, attempted murder, and manslaughter charges. Not only was the Black community outraged about the police abuse that unfolded during Penn's traffic stop, but so was the judge who presided over the trial. Law enforcement's flagrant abuse of Penn that night was not unique to Penn's situation. It was emblematic of the day-to-day interactions between members of San Diego's law enforcement and the residents of southeastern part of San Diego, which houses the greatest concentration of Black residents in the city of San Diego to this day, as DeAndre Brooks just spoke about. This particular incident of police violence and abuse, however, was a catalyzing force that brought about San Diego's first review board on police practices, which was supposed to be a check on police misconduct. This type of police abuse is not the only mistreatment Black San Diegans were and are still subjected to. African Americans in San Diego are victims of over-policing and arbitrary and selective enforcement of our laws, which stem from bias in policing, which is rooted in white supremacy. Emblematic of the harassment that Black San Diegans are subjected to is the U.S. Supreme Court case Collender versus Lawson. Edward Lawson was detained or arrested on about 15 occasions between March 1975 and January 1977 pursuant to California Penal Code Section 647E. At the time, this penal code section prohibited persons from loitering or wandering upon the streets or from place to place without apparent reason or business and refusing to identify themselves to account for their presence when requested by a peace officer to do so if the surrounding circumstances are such as to indicate to a reasonable man that the public safety demands such identification. I know, that was a lot. From the trial transcript, we learned that the stops of Mr. Lawson were arbitrary in nature. On the first occasion, Mr. Lawson, who was new to San Diego, was simply walking home from a party on what he called a beautiful San Diego day and was arrested for violating Penal Code Section 647E. And as he recalls, as he got out of jail for this first offense, he was cited again. It's important to note that Lawson had never been stopped by police for any reason apart from his 15 or so detentions under this law. In his own words, he would, quote unquote, just be going to the curb or leaving his residence while living in La Jolla when detained or arrested. And it shouldn't be lost on us that La Jolla is an affluent area known for its history of redlining and restrictive covenants keeping Black people out. Lawson found during conversations with his friends that these citations were commonplace for young Black people. He decided to fight his citations on constitutional grounds. No one would take Lawson's case, so he fought the citations representing himself all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court and won. The named defendant in Collender versus Lawson was Bill Collender, who was the chief of police of the San Diego Police Department at that time and who later became San Diego County's sheriff. True to form, the San Diego Police Department and its chief could not accept an adverse ruling and appealed the case all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. Now, while striking down this statute really set an important precedent, the underlying facts that brought about this case in the first place are crucially important and deserve attention. So let's go back to the Black codes and Jim Crow law. This California statute was being arbitrarily enforced against Black people as a means by which law enforcement could and did monitor and control the actions of Black people in San Diego. And this was not lost on Mr. Edward Lawson, who likened his experience and the experience of other people like him who were being harassed by law enforcement by way of this statute to the past laws in South Africa during apartheid. The past laws of 1952 required Black South Africans over the age of 16 to carry a passbook everywhere and at all times. The past laws was a system used to control the movement of Black, Indian, and colored people in South Africa. I share these stories because each of these men stood up and fought against the system that was determined to subjugate them and in some cases commit violence against them and change some aspect of policing in standing up. But while honoring their acts of bravery and courage and the honoring of their own manhood and humanity, one must not gloss over the traumatic experiences each man had to endure. Saigon Penn paid the ultimate price. In his case, he was never able to have peace. Despite his acquittals, he was a constant target of the San Diego District Attorney's Office and local police agencies. And for the next 17 years of his life, Sagon Penn endured their constant harassment and struggled with mental health and other issues as a result of the traumatic experience on the night of May 31st, 1985. Sagon would tell his friends and family that he couldn't have a life as a result of that fateful night. Sagon Penn was liberated from the constant harassment in this life on July 4th, 2002. Finally, in honoring their stories, we must also acknowledge not only that white supremacy underpins our policing institutions and systems, but also the need to rid ourselves of it. Although the data is clear that African Americans are policed differently in San Diego, the city attorney nor any of her representatives made any mention that San Diego's outdated seditious language laws were selectively enforced in a discriminating way against African Americans when they decided to repeal it back in 2020. And even after commissioning their own reports that confirmed that Black drivers are stopped and searched disproportionately when compared to their white counterparts, both the San Diego Police and Sheriff Departments have doubled down on their arguments that these quote-unquote disparities don't equate to bias or discriminatory policing. We know that given the history of policing in this country and in this state, we cannot separate the fruits we see from the root of white supremacy and institutionalized racism. For this reason, I ask that this body consider proposals that will result in a complete reimagining of our criminal legal and policing systems and address collective trauma. I don't believe that we have two justice systems. I don't believe that this country is home to any justice systems. I also don't believe that our criminal legal system is broken. It is working the way it was intended. That being said, I thank this task force again for allowing me the opportunity to share a few thoughts and, of course, for undertaking this great work.
Thank you so much, Ms. Jones Wright, for that amazing expert testimony. Really appreciate you. So we'll now turn to Dave Mitchell for his expert testimony. And Dave Mitchell, you may begin when you're ready.
Good afternoon. My name is David Mitchell. As Ms. Moore mentioned, I'm a criminal defense attorney and president of Vital Projects Fund, a charitable foundation that gives grants to organizations that seek to end mass incarceration. In my mind, one of the clearest examples of reparations being implemented in recent years has been the social equity provisions enacted in a number of American states in the wake of marijuana legalization. While these provisions differ from place to place, they include things like, one, the expungement of old marijuana convictions, two, special licensing regimes that provide economic opportunities to those previously convicted of marijuana offenses, and three, public investment in communities that were disproportionately impacted by marijuana criminalization. These social equity provisions are worth examining because I think they might provide a useful model for reparations for individuals and communities that have been unjustly criminalized and oversentenced in other contexts. Generally speaking, when we make changes to the criminal law, we don't provide reparations to those previously convicted and sentenced under the prior legal regime. I think the fact that many jurisdictions have chosen to provide reparations in the wake of marijuana legalization is in part because we have an intuition that our prior marijuana laws were not merely imperfect, deficient, or warranting improvement, but rather because the laws were immoral, unjust, and enforced in a racially disparate manner. In other words, I think these reparation provisions reflect the fact that our culture has had a moral awakening with regard to marijuana criminalization, an awakening perhaps not unlike the moral awakening that accompanied the abolition of slavery and the end of Jim Crow. And we have a sense that that awakening creates an accompanying moral imperative: provide reparations to those who were victimized. I would further submit that if we look carefully at some of the other criminal justice reforms California has made in the past decade, there are other changes that might fall into this category, where we might say that the reforms reflect not merely an effort to fix deficient laws, but rather a deeper moral judgment that the prior laws were cruel, unjust, and racist. And like with marijuana, we should consider reparations to individuals and communities unfairly impacted by those laws. So what are some of the reforms that may fall into this category? Here are a few worth considering. Number one, Proposition 36. In 2012, by a vote of 69% to 31%, Californians enacted Proposition 36 that amended California's draconian three strikes law. While other states had enacted these kinds of habitual offender laws during the 1990s, California's three strikes law was one of the broadest and harshest in the nation, providing for decades-long mandatory minimum sentences for a third strike offense, even when that offense was nonviolent and exceedingly minor. Individuals convicted of petty thefts, like stealing a slice of pizza, a pair of white tube socks, or a pair of baby shoes, ended up with exorbitant decades-long sentences. Similarly, individuals convicted of possession of a single dose of heroin ended up with life sentences. In some instances, like a famous case where a man received a 50-year mandatory minimum for stealing five videotapes of children's movies, the third strike sentence for shoplifting was more than six times longer than the sentence that same individual would have received for rape. It is worth noting that California's three strikes law, enacted amidst a media-generated hysteria in the wake of the kidnapping and murder of 12-year-old Polly Class, has since been repudiated by Class's own sisters. They now call California's three strikes law a, quote, pervasive injustice. They recently told Elle magazine, quote, it's difficult to describe how strange it is to be connected to this legacy of mass incarceration, and then to carry the shame and the pain of that legacy. It's been heavy for us for a really long time. In short, even the people in whose name California passed its three strikes law have come to see it not just as a misguided policy, but as unjust and shameful. Number two, SB 1010. In 2014, California enacted Senate Bill 1010, which eliminated the state's crack cocaine disparity. Prior to the reform, California provided harsher punishments for the sale of crack cocaine than powder cocaine, and it made it harder for those convicted of crack offenses to qualify for probation. Similarly, a far smaller amount of crack cocaine than powder cocaine triggered the forfeiture of property used in drug-related commerce. It is now widely acknowledged that there is, quote, no scientific basis, close quote, for treating crack and powder cocaine differently. Indeed, California's 2014 reform law contained a legislative finding that crack and powder cocaine are, quote, two different forms of the same drug. The prior law produced dramatic racial disparities. 77% of those in prison for crack offenses were black, whereas less than 2% were white. Number three, SB 1437. In 2018, California enacted Senate Bill 1437, which amended the archaic felony murder rule and the natural and probable consequences doctrine, dramatically narrowing the circumstances in which people who neither kill nor intend to kill can be convicted of murder as though they were the actual killer. The reform bill recognized the inherent unfairness of pre-existing law and provided retroactive relief to those who had been convicted prior to the reform's enactment. Prior to the reform law, merely agreeing to participate in certain felonies made one strictly liable for any death that occurred. Thus, a person could be charged with first or second degree murder even for homicides that one did not commit, did not intend, and did not foresee, and even those about which one had no knowledge. So people like Nico Wilson could be prosecuted for first degree murder in connection with the deaths of a couple during a robbery in the Central Valley, even though prosecutors conceded that Wilson had merely helped to plan the robbery and was not physically present when the robbery or the deaths occurred. In short, prior to the reforms, California law allowed people who were peripheral to felonies, lookouts, getaway drivers, and other minor participants, to be prosecuted as though they were the trigger man in an intentional first-degree murder. This law frequently ensnared people like women and youth who played a small role in the crimes of others. Indeed, 72% of the women serving a life sentence for homicide in California did not actually commit the homicide. England and other Commonwealth countries around the world that previously employed the felony murder rule have long since narrowed or abandoned it because it's archaic and produces unjust results. And indeed, the California Supreme Court itself has called the felony murder rule, quote, barbaric. In short, there is significant evidence that California's SB 1437 did not merely reform an imperfect law, but sought to end a pervasive injustice. Number four, SB 394. In 2017, California ended JLWAP sentences, that is, life without the possibility of parole sentences for juveniles. Prior to its enactment, California had more than 300 children serving such sentences, and California was one of just 9 states that accounted for more than 80% of JLWAP sentences nationwide. Of the more than 3,000 counties in America, Los Angeles County was the second most prolific user of such sentences. JLWAP sentences first became common during the 1990s at the height of what has now become known as the juvenile super predator panic. The panic was initially fueled by Princeton professor John DeLulio, who then seized on by politicians in the media who opined that a new generation of youth that had, quote, no respect for human life was going to drive a crime wave unprecedented in U.S. history. In the coming years, juvenile crime didn't rise. In fact, it plummeted. For his part, DeLulio has since admitted he was wrong, expressed remorse, and joined a brief to the U.S. Supreme Court repudiating his own work. As many have subsequently noted, the juvenile super predator panic specifically tapped into and amplified racial stereotypes, suggesting black children, were predatory and prone to criminality. And in fact, among children arrested for homicide, black kids were twice as likely to be sentenced to JLWAP as white kids. In California, black youth were 18 times more likely to receive such a sentence than white youth. As the U.S. Supreme Court has pointed out, the differences between adult and adolescent brains make adolescents less morally culpable than adults and render adolescents more capable of rehabilitation, making the irrevocability of a JLWAP sentence inappropriate. Indeed, brain science shows that adolescents are more susceptible to impulsivity, risk-taking behavior, and peer pressure, and less likely to weigh the consequences of their actions than adults, because their brains are still developing. In California, more than half of the children who received the sentence did so as part of a crime with an adult, and in many cases, the child played a peripheral role. For these reasons, in recent years, more than 30 U.S. states have abandoned the practice of sentencing children to JLWAP in law and in practice, and the U.S. remains the only nation in the world that allows JLWAP at all. In short, California's SB 394 that eliminated such sentences might reasonably be seen as a moral awakening, not merely a practical change in the law. In conclusion, the 4 changes to the law that I've discussed are merely illustrative of a broader point, that as we look at the era of mass incarceration and begin to make reforms to the criminal law, some portion of these reforms will reflect an intuition that the laws being changed were not merely deficient or warranting improvement, but were barbaric, immoral, and unjust. And when a law falls into that second category, when we have a moral awakening, we have a moral responsibility to repair the harm we have done through reparations, like giving special economic benefits to people who were victimized and special economic investments into communities that suffer disproportionate enforcement. Thank you.
Excellent expert testimony. Our last panelist for this particular panel is Charles Ramsey. So without further ado, Mr. Ramsey, you may begin your expert testimony. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you very much and good afternoon. It is still afternoon in California. I'm in Philadelphia, so a little different time zone. But thank you so much for inviting me to participate on this panel. I'll try to keep my comments as brief as I can to allow for time for questions. Having served on a commission, I know what it's like when you have the panel testimony and you're anxious to ask a question or two and you have to kind of wait till the end. So I'll do the best I can in trying to keep it short. My name is Chuck Ramsey. My background is in policing. I started my policing career. I'm a native Chicagoan. I began my policing career in Chicago in 1968 as a police cadet. I spent 30 years as a member of the Chicago Police Department. I left in 1998 to become police chief in Washington, D.C., where I served for nearly 9 years, retired very briefly, and then took on Philadelphia, where I served as police commissioner for 8 years. It was mentioned early on during the introductions that in 2015, I had the honor of serving as co-chair of President Obama's Task Force on 21st Century Policing, which came about in the aftermath of Ferguson, Missouri, Michael Brown and Eric Garner in New York. President Obama at the time wanted to have a in-depth review of policing with solid concrete recommendations. And we did produce a document with some 92 action step 61 recommendations, which many departments are using to this day. But to focus on narcotics, if I may, drugs, I do have a background in drug enforcement. When I served in the Chicago Police Department as a sergeant, I was a member of the narcotics section from roughly 1978 to 1984. So about 6 years I served in that capacity. I returned to that unit and was reassigned there in 1991 or so as the commander of Organized Crime Division Narcotics Section. So most of my street experience with narcotics comes from my time in the Chicago Police Department, although obviously Philadelphia and D.C. had more than a share of issues surrounding crime. So this so-called war on drugs, I was one of the people that actually was assigned to narcotics during that period of time. Obviously, the so-called war failed. It failed on a lot of different levels. But primarily, in my opinion, it failed because there was nothing really provided for treatment and prevention. Everything was geared toward enforcement. And that was pretty much the mandate, you know, get the drugs off the street. When crack cocaine hit in the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s in Chicago, there was a great deal of violence that was associated with open-air drug trafficking. And so that just amped things up a bit in terms of enforcement activity. But again, there was very little done in the area of treatment or prevention. I also think that this whole the legislation that was passed, and again, I'm not familiar with California law. I can only address laws in the cities where I worked. But that disparity in crack cocaine versus powdered cocaine, at the time they did it, many of us in narcotics didn't understand why. I mean, it's all cocaine. It's just a different form of cocaine. And we didn't understand the need to pass that kind of legislation, but it was passed, and it did lead to a disproportionate number and lengthy incarceration of primarily people of color. So again, there were a lot of things that went wrong. There's absolutely no question about that during that period of time. And fortunately, I think there are some things that are being done to try at least to correct some of that. When I served as co-chair of the task force, we addressed six specific areas, and we limited it to six because the president, you know, he wanted a report on his desk within a relatively short period of time. We had some 45 days or so in order to actually sit down and actually work on the report. We had, by the way, it wasn't just a law enforcement project. We had civil rights attorneys. We had people that had just come off the protest lines in both Ferguson and New York that were part of this. We did have law enforcement. We had constitutional lawyers. We had a variety of people, 11 in total, that made up the task force. We were able to reach consensus on every single recommendation that you'll find in that report. Despite our varied backgrounds, we were able to come up with the recommendations in which we all agreed were needed in order to improve policing. The very first thing we tackled was building trust and legitimacy, and it was mentioned earlier when going through the history of policing. And policing has a very, very bad history, especially as it relates to people of color. There's no question about that. But the people we're hiring today weren't alive during some of that. I mean, I'm 72 years old. I remember the actual civil rights movement of the 60s and so forth. We aren't hiring 72-year-old cops. We're hiring 20 or 21-year-old cops. So it's very important that that history be incorporated in training, because people need to understand, officers need to understand in their specific cities, whether you're talking San Diego, Philadelphia, Chicago, or Washington, D.C., what's the history of policing in that particular city, especially as it relates to communities of color. And I think if we're going to make any progress moving forward, that's a very important part of what needs to be done. Certainly, there have been some changes in terms of legislation and sentencing and those kinds of things, but not enough is being done, because we do need to focus on reentry. We do need to focus on treatment and prevention. We do need to focus on housing and substance abuse, addiction, and all those kinds of things if we really want to turn the situation we have around in terms of crime on the streets of our city, some of which is drug-driven, but a lot of it isn't drug-driven. So we have a variety of areas that we need to really aggressively go after in the sense of trying to turn it around, trying to change people's lives. And everything doesn't have to be with arrest and incarceration. We need alternatives to incarceration. They need to be fully funded so that there is options available other than just jail, because many people do not belong in jail. But there does need to be some kind of consequence for their action, but it doesn't have to be incarceration. There are, of course, others that commit more serious crimes that do need to be incarcerated, in my opinion. But that's not the majority. The majority of people, I think we can find alternatives. But they have to get serious about the funding that's needed if we're ever going to get beyond this cycle of having discussions around these issues. And then, you know, 2 or 3 years later, we have a discussion pretty much like the one we had before, because nothing really changes. And it's not going to change unless we make it change. So I'm going to end there, because I think it's important, and I'm sure there's some questions, not only for me, but other panelists as well. But thanks again for inviting me, and any questions you have, I'm more than happy to answer.
Thank you again, Mr. Ramsey, for your expert testimony. So we'll now turn to our lead task force members in the event they have any questions or comments related to the panel's testimonies. At this point, would any task force member like to be recognized? If so, feel free to speak. Senator Rapper, you're recognized.
Thank you. And once again, I think we had compelling testimony. And as a chair of public safety, along with Mr. Jones Sawyer on the assembly side, much of what we heard today is not new. And that's the real tragedy here. But I think if it's a connective tissue that continues to tie us to slavery, I think it's policing and how folks have been mass incarcerated and all kind of just horrible things that was described today. And one of the things, again, seems like all roads lead to Dr. Weber. 4 years ago, we passed AB 392, ending the use of deadly force here in California. But if we knew the history, deadly force was imposed in California. When I asked people what year, many people said, oh, 1940, 1950. No, in 1872. What was different in California from 1850 to 1872, 22 years later? African Americans were free. And the right to kill black folks is why we implemented the use of deadly force here in California. And it was a fight to get it changed. And we talked about cocaine, marijuana earlier today too. Marijuana was put on a Schedule 1 in their 30s, again, to incarcerate African Americans. Watch the movie Reefer Madness. It showed that if you smoke marijuana, you're going to act like a cannibal and act like some savage beast and all that. So I say all that. It's clear we have to really look at this area. I think it's impacting folks daily. And that's why much of the legislation I've done since I've been here is in the area of police reform last year with SB2, allowing us to get rid of these bad cops who continue to violate the law, abuse population. Again, majority of people, African American, I'll just stop on this. As they were talking about cannabis as well, 8 years ago, I did a bill after doing research. The majority of African Americans who were arrested or cited for the possession of marijuana, got an additional charge that white folks never got. Now it's transporting. Even if you had a $10 bag and you were on a bike, a skateboard, or in a car, they gave you the additional charge of transporting. Well, we had white folks flying down Sunset Boulevard or Pacific Coast Highway in Malibu with an ounce of cocaine, and all they got was a possession charge. So this is an area that we really need to look at because there is a clear nexus. Slavery and what we see today, this is an extension of it. So I'll just stop there. But thank you for all the testimony. And, you know, we got a lot of work to do.
Thank you, Senator Bradford. Thanks for your work on decertification. Assemblymember Reggie Jones, you're recognized.
And one of the scariest things for law enforcement and for white people who want to continue slavery is the fact that in California, the chairs of both the Senate and Assembly Public Safety are two brothers. We are like right now the gatekeepers. We're now in a fight right now to stop the school-to-prison pipeline. Mr. Bradford and I, yesterday, we missed part of the meeting yesterday because we were dealing with members of the Assembly and the Senate that are constantly bringing in bills to overturn Prop 47, to bring back three strikes, to do whatever they can to go back to the day when we were overcrowded in prisons. When I got here in 2012, we're like at 150,000. And because of the work of the Black Caucus and others, we're now down below 100,000, which means we need fewer prison guards. And with that, the prison guards came after me in 2020, spent $2 million to try to get me out of office because we were, as a group, we were going to close prisons. And we are closing prisons now. And that has never been done in the history of California. We build prisons like it's going out of style, but we do not close prisons. And right now, we're in task to close at least five prisons right now. And that's never been done in the history of California. But that also means that people aren't recidivating, costing us $80,000 to $100,000 a year to incarcerate people that look like us. When we could spend the same amount, 4 years, they have a degree, and they're working in society. But we're spending all this money for LWOP, for life without a possibility of parole, for life sentences to keep black people in jail because it feeds the prison industrial system. It's an insidious system that is worth billions and billions of jobs and billions of dollars. And to fuel that, law enforcement has to feed the dragon. And unfortunately, that the way they feed that prison population is with us. That's what they do. They feed it with us. Right now in California, we're trying to cut that off, not only here, but I had meetings with the L.A. County, with our new chair of L.A. County, Holly Mitchell, and Sheila Kuehl. And all they want to do is programs that deal with healing and getting people back into society. And because they know that affects disproportionately, as you could see in the material you saw, the sheriff that we have in L.A. County is no joke. And if he has his way and gets reelected, he is going to not only put more black and brown folk in jail, I worry about the ones that survive an encounter with the L.A. sheriff over those years. And so we're now working to hopefully get someone in there that's the exact opposite and that is going to work with us to make sure that harm that you've all heard today, that Mr. Bradford and I have known and have been dealing with for several years. When he says we should make this at the top of our concern, because this is a direct damage that you can link directly back to slavery. And the last thing I would leave you with, I have a board in my office, and it has badges of all of the early slave hunters. They used to have badges. And if you look at those badges, they look exactly like a sheriff badge. Exactly like a sheriff badge. And the policies, procedures, and the way they trap and ensnare slaves back then are still being used today. And so we're trying to unravel that. We're getting rid of the chokeholds and things of that nature. But you need to understand law enforcement's investment in keeping us imprisoned is their business model. And we've got to do what we need to do to reverse that, stop it. And as I said before, stop this river of racism that's just rolling into our community. Thank you.
I did have a question for Chief Ramsey real quick, if you don't mind. And I wish you would just expound on really quick the whole movement on menthol, too, and its impacts on the African-American community, the ban on menthol cigarettes.
I don't. First of all, I'm a former smoker, and I smoke menthol cigarettes when I did smoke. So I don't understand the sense in it. I think all smoking is bad, whether it's menthol or not. I stopped in 1985 because I knew it was damaging my health, and I wanted to live a little longer. That's why I stopped, but I preferred menthol cigarettes to the regular cigarettes. I don't know if that was an addiction issue or not. I have no idea, but I don't understand why. I think all smoking is bad, period, but I don't think it needs to be criminalized. It's a health issue, and it ought to be treated as a health issue, and that's part of the problem, even with drugs, especially when I'm talking about the users, not the dealers, but the users. It's a health issue. And if you deal with it as a health issue, because again, treatment, prevention, you always need a prevention component because you got to stop the next generation from starting to start using themselves. And so that to me is how you deal with issues like that. But I heard that on the news and I just shook my head because I had no clue as to what the heck that was supposed to do in terms of making the streets any safer or communities stronger. I have zero idea.
Just gave police more opportunities and reasons to stop black folks again and arrest us because we're the biggest users of menthol cigarettes.
Well, it's a public health issue, and it needs to be handled as a public health issue. And the other side of the coin of that is you put officers in jeopardy, too, because the more times you have to stop individuals and the more things you interactions, number one, we never get past this you know, trust and legitimacy issue within black and brown communities, because you're constantly doing stuff, minor stuff, you know, whether it's enforcing cigarettes or whatever it might be, you know, and that's, so it hurts the profession, it hurts everybody when things like that happen.
Member Grills, you are recognized.
Thank you. My question is for Mr. Menchel, but actually this could go to any of the presenters, and thank you so much for your testimony today. Mr. Menchel mentioned in your testimony that you said the laws being changed were not merely deficient or warranting improvement, but were barbaric, immoral, and unjust. And you go on to talk about that this second category kind of falls into a moral awakening. And I'm not so sure about the moral awakening because morality really hasn't been an imperative in how America has dealt with us. Neither has fairness and this notion of blind justice. So I'm wondering whether or not, if we think about ways to promote non-repetition, would something like a policy practice similar to what's done in environmental policy be helpful? Specifically, they do things like either an environmental assessment or an environmental impact assessment. And what that means is that before a policy can go into effect, a policy, a plan, or a program or projects, there has to be an assessment to determine potential unintended consequences for certain groups of people or for the environment, et cetera. Do you think instituting something like that might help us to avoid laws like the ones that we've seen in the past that were clearly to the disadvantage of Black people? Would that be something that would be helpful?
I think it might be. I mean, I think I think you know, having the legislature consider the racial impacts of laws that it's passing and being forced to confront those, you know, it would be helpful. I think, you know, a lot of these laws, you know, one of the most interesting things about the current moment, I think, is that we're seeing legislatures confront a stronger criminal justice reform movement than has existed. Like, you know, back in the 90s, people could kind of put their head in the sand and claim, oh, well, we didn't know that when we passed this three strikes law, it was going to have this effect. But it strikes me that the criminal justice reform movement is much more powerful now than it was back then, and has really forced legislators to look at the disproportionate racial impacts of virtually every aspect of the criminal justice system. I mean, I don't think you could find a single a provision of law that isn't you know, disproportionately enforced against Black people and other people of color. So whether they care or not, I think it's a different matter. I mean, but forcing them to say, like, look, you know, you know that this is going to produce dramatic racial disparities, and you're passing it anyway. I mean, I do, unfortunately, I think that may be where we are in America, that there's a very powerful criminal justice reform movement that is capable of proving these things, and that the typical Republican and Democrat in state legislatures couldn't care, really just doesn't care at all. They're happy to lock up Black people. Not a big deal.
Can I just add something real quickly? I don't know about California, but in the places where I've worked, and when they talk about criminal justice reform, it tends to be limited to just police reform. Now, that's not to say that police don't need reform. Police do need reform. There's no question about that. But if you don't address the rest of the criminal justice system, nothing's going to really change. You have to deal with the entire system and understand the changes you make one place has a ripple effect on the system somewhere else. And you don't know that if you don't sit down and really think it through. So we need to look at police. We need to look at prosecution. We need to look at defense, because defense attorneys need to be adequately paid to get quality defense. You need to look at corrections. You need to look at reentry. You need to look at all these kinds of things, because they all are connected. And what I see happening, at least in the places where I have been, it tends to get stuck in one place and doesn't go any further. And I think that's a mistake personally. There needs to be criminal justice reform. The last comprehensive look at the entire criminal justice system was when LBJ was president of the United States. And some of you weren't even born when Lyndon Baines Johnson was president. Now, I think a lot has changed since LBJ was president. It's time we took another look.
This is Lisa Holder. I want to thank the panel. I wanted to direct my question to Chief Ramsey, but to anyone on the panel as well, just sort of following up on your comments about public health. And about how so many of these issues that we are seeing being criminalized are really public health issues.
Mm-hmm.
Now, because for the last 50 years, we have criminalized everything, that has been the panacea, send them to jail, send Black people to jail specifically. We haven't developed an infrastructure within the public health system to deal with these issues that are actually public health issues, right? Like alcoholism, mental health, homelessness, drug use. There's a whole panoply, right, of these public health issues that have been put into the criminal bucket, and we have not developed an infrastructure, a public health infrastructure to handle these issues. And, you know, one of the scholars who talked to us today indicated that 4% of police deployment is actually focused on serious crimes, like murder and violent crime. 4% of police deployment. The vast majority of police deployment is dealing with these public health issues, and also really, you know, focused on predictive policing and using technology in policing. And so you have this 96% that's not about serious crime. That really should be more in the public health bucket. So, you know, how do we convince police officers and build consensus with this policing system to start moving resources to build a public health infrastructure and reduce the policing footprint.
Well, if I may, it's not just about police. The police have that 96%, as you say, because cities have underfunded social services for decades. And the only people left are police. At 2 o'clock in the morning on a Friday night, you think you're going to get a mental health worker to come out if you've got a disturbance with a person who's undergoing a mental health crisis? No. They're going to call a police officer. So we put in some training, crisis intervention team training and so forth. I don't care what kind of training you give them. They'll never be as good as a professional in that particular field. And so until cities start to fund properly, and that doesn't mean you can just get that. If you think you'll only get it from defunding police for 1 year, it needs a whole lot more money than anything you can pull out of a police department. I mean, over time, you could shrink the size of a police department, but it's going to take time to hire up enough mental health workers. It's going to take time to hire up enough substance abuse folks that can actually be in the field, homeless outreach workers, all these kinds of folks. And so I'm not disagreeing with you, but legislators pass legislation that criminalize stuff, and what do police do? Enforce laws. So stop passing laws to criminalize all this stuff. That's one thing that can be done. And then cities need to properly fund these different social services and public health and all those kinds of things. When I think of safety, I no longer think of public safety. And I'll tell you why. When I think of public safety, and it's because I'm old, I guess, I think of police, fire, emergency management, emergency medical, because traditionally that is what has been under the umbrella of public safety. I think about community safety now, because it's not just crime that makes people unsafe. You've got mental health issues. You do have homelessness. You got to deal with poverty. You got to deal with housing. You got to deal with all these things because it impacts quality of life in neighborhoods. And until we start really thinking in a different way and providing the resources to be able to come up with a real plan that can be sustained over time, you're not going to see much difference. And it's easy to just say, well, give it to the cops and give them more training. Well, they'll never be as good in these areas as anyone else, and that's not what they signed up to be. And so if you could shrink a police department by a third, a half, or whatever, because they're only focusing in limited areas and everybody else is properly funded and able to pick up the slack, I've not talked to a single police chief that objects to that. But the reality is cities do not follow up. They don't put their money where their mouth is. They say these things, but then they don't provide the funds on a regular basis. That's just a fact. I'm sorry if there's someone who gets offended, but it's just real.
Thank you. Are there any other last comments from the task force members? If not, thank you so much to our panelists for this amazing testimonies that you all provided. I'm looking forward to staying connected with you all. So thanks again.
Thank you.
For your time. Thank you.
We can sign off now.
All right. Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Bradford and Assembly Reggie Jones-Sawyer, for your work on these issues as well. So the next item on our agenda is agenda item number 20, which is potential action item, next meeting agenda, and witnesses. Okay. So at this time, can we get some assistance from the DOJ to put on the screen, I think the proposal that Jovan and I came up with first, and then we can go to the draft agenda that you all made for April.
Madam Chair, we are currently loading up those documents. We'll just be one moment.
Actually, we can start with the draft agenda for April. And I don't have a problem sharing my screen either. So, I mean, I'm patient, so it's fine, but I can also share my screen.
I'm sorry, I have it up, but it's not transferring over. If someone has a copy and can share it quickly, it's not allowing me to share.
Oh.
Hi, Dr. Brown. Now, I'm trying to figure out how to share. Okay, can people see the screen?
Yes, I can.
Okay, thank you. Okay. So this is the draft agenda for our April meeting. And so the April meeting will be our first in-person meeting, and it will be held on April 13th, 2022 and April 14th, 2022. So in January of 2022, we stated that we're going to discuss the final report approval in the April meeting. We're also going to discuss how to educate the California public on the findings in the report. And in the February meeting, the task force also adopted that we would have some panels on educational disparities from pre-K to 12th grade to also tertiary education as well. We also said we would have an introduction to the communication firms and their communication strategy. So potential items for task force consideration. Does the task force have any feedback to share with staff on the potential witnesses for upcoming meetings? And then I'll show the potential witnesses listed below. Please note that the DOJ staff will rely on this list to reach out to potential witnesses. Please also note that DOJ staff will continue to add witness names to this list recommended by task force members, as potential witnesses may decline their invitation to testify. Other discussion on action items. The task force may wish to consider whether to include other items on the agenda. The DOJ staff will work to create space on the agenda for additional items on the agenda. Please note that the template agenda included below is a draft and will change. So this is a template agenda for April 13th, which would be around community education, community disparities in institutions. So the first panel would be on pre-K to 12th grade education institutions. The second panel would be on college to professional educational institutions. And the third panel would be on school to prison pipeline. And then there is a community engagement plan update by Member Grills, and then a subpoena update by Members Tamaki and Holder, and then informational item from the DOJ. I'm just going to go to the next day, just so people are aware. The next day is reserved for Report 1 and educating the public on the findings for Report 1. We're essentially starting that conversation about how we will educate the public. So really the first action item of that particular day would be a final discussion on Report 1 and vote on Report 1, led by Attorney Newman and Attorney Yang. And then we would hear from the communication firms to introduce themselves and discuss present and to present their communication strategies. And then we would also have some time with the economic consultant team again to further discuss and refine the scope of work. And then we'll present myself and Lewis ideas before the task force for the schedule for future meetings. to get your vote and approval. And then, yeah, we will set the agenda for the next meeting. So does anyone have any thoughts around the draft agenda? Do you see anything that's missing? Did you want to make known some of your potential witness recommendations? If so, this is the time to do so. And I'll stop sharing my screen for the moment.
This is a question
Madam Chair.
Vice Chair Brown, I heard member Holder first, so I'm going to go to her, and then I'll go to you, Vice Chair Brown.
Thanks. Just a question for Attorney Brown. What is the deadline that you indicated for witnesses for the next meeting?
Oh, that would be on Monday, April the 4th.
Okay.
And we just, again, want to remind folks that the task force will be meeting in person at Third Baptist Church in San Francisco. So any witnesses that are confirmed would have to be present in person to provide testimony.
And do you anticipate that now that we're moving over to in-person meetings, it's going to be more difficult to confirm witnesses? So you would like us to provide you with maybe a longer list of witnesses, or do you not anticipate that?
Certainly, you know, if travel is contemplated and could pose a potential barrier to anticipating having a number of witnesses to choose from would be helpful. If members would also like to perhaps rank by priority the witnesses that they suggest for any particular panel, we can certainly, you know, make sure that our efforts are focused based on those priorities as well.
Okay, so I'm pretty sure it's clear on my side, but just for the public. So since we're meeting in person, that disallows anyone to give virtual testimony, so to speak, right? So the task force members are meeting in person, which means that all the witnesses have to meet in person. So we cannot allow for virtual testimony of any kind.
That's correct.
Help me understand. We're in the legislature, and we're still taking virtual testimony every day, which extends our hearings for hours, and we can't take folks calling in and testifying remotely? I think we're doing a great disservice if we're going to ask somebody to travel to be able to testify. We're going to shut off public comment and input that way. We're taking it in the legislature. We've been taking it now for 2 years. People allow, even though we're back open, people are still allowed to phone in and testify.